Just to start off with, can you give the listeners a bit of a background about yourself?
Who am I? I'm an independent journalist. What does that mean? It means that I didn't graduate from graduate school in journalism. I was a writer. I had some success. I got hired at a newspaper. I was good at asking questions. I worked at a little paper in Boston. I did a lot of independent stuff for other things. Mostly it means I'm a very curious person with good research skills. That shouldn't put me too far above anybody else in the listening audience. I did grow up in a family of doctors and medical researchers. I have no particular fear of doctors, no particular love or hatred of them. They're just people to me, like people in your family. And so it was very easy for me to ask many questions without feeling worried that I was going to be punished, because I grew up watching people argue about medicine.
Yeah.
You know, when you grow up in a family of doctors, something happens to you. You see that the things that you're told are absolutely true are ideas that can be used in arguments by uncles against each other. These things that are so sacrosanct, and you know, you're told, well, this is absolute, it suddenly becomes just the latest idea that's there. And you know, one of my uncles could say to the other, well, of course that's wrong, and that'll be proven wrong in this paper, and this is what I'm saying, and that's old-fashioned, and you know, just the idea that you're not supposed to question a doctor, that there's something, you know, religiously profoundly sacred about what comes out of the guys in the white jackets was lost on me from a very early age because I saw them drunk.
I'll say briefly, which is probably a crazy word to use when we're talking about this issue, but can you briefly explain what the HIV-AIDS myth is, or what the alternative theories about HIV and AIDS are that you have been researching and that you have been writing about?
Sure. AIDS is a brand name. There was a phenomenon in this country, in my country, the United States, in the early 80s, in a very small community, the gay community over here. We still imagine, as many people in Western countries do, that we're supposed to care about adults who adults have sex with and that sort of thing. Now this sort of goes beyond me at this point. I don't really understand it, even though I have my religious friends and my strong spiritual interests. It's just beyond me to understand this. But this is something we're really concerned about. And so if you're gay, or if you are, you know, want to have sex with somebody of the same sex, you've always had a hard time in this country and in many parts of the world for a long time. The gay community in my country didn't really exist until after, well, there was sort of the so-called sexual revolution here in the 60s, where, again, a really small part of the population decided to experiment a little bit with flaunting the Judeo-Christian moral structure regarding sex and, you know, marriage and this sort of thing. And the gay people sort of followed along and decided, well, if it's good for the goose, you know. And what happened was this: there was this thing called Stonewall. There was a protest at a bar in New York where, if you can imagine, the police were regularly, you know, bothering and beating up the gay guys who were going to their bar in their little neighborhood tavern in Greenwich Village in New York. And there was a protest, and after that, in 69, there was a sort of a gay community, and these guys lived in these little gay ghettos. The regular culture still doesn't want to sort of acknowledge that people have many kinds of sexuality. And what happened was what happens to any culture living in any sort of ghetto. You develop ghetto-like behaviors. You have a tiny world that you live in. It's a few blocks long. You can't go home. You can't really talk to the people that you used to know before you came out. People did a lot of drugs. They did a lot of partying. They had a lot of STDs. They took a lot of antibiotics between and before and after sex partners and going to the baths and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, they got sick over the course of a decade for a lot of reasons. I don't know all the reasons, but they certainly wore themselves out. By the late 70s, some of them were dying. When they went into the hospital, they weren't treated very well. A lot of them were more or less poisoned. They were given very, very... There's something in the West that I call the patient is very sick, let's drug them mercilessly, medical standard. So you take anybody who's sick, who has a multiplicity of illnesses and effects going on in their body, and then you give them drugs that absolutely decimate their immune system, and you hope that they survive. So this is what happened. These guys went into the hospital. They were injected with pentamidine, which is a fungicide. They were given radiation, when they were having effects from these carcinogenic drugs they were doing. It was a mess. And a lot of guys died. And, you know, the original idea was that they died or they were sick because, you know, they were doing all this stuff. But that didn't really make some people happy because they felt that it would increase homophobia. And, then some guys at our National Cancer Institute, essentially, National Institute of Health, got a hold of it, and they decided that they would, you know, try to prop up the idea that it was all caused by the sex. And, you know, that fit well with the idea that it was gay people and all the rest of it. And then they made it a brand name. First it was called GRID, then it was called AIDS. And then once it was a name, AIDS, for what happened in a particular community, whatever you think the cause was, I mean, I think it's multifactorial, and I think that that's pretty clear in the medical and historical record. But whatever the things going on were, they took the name AIDS. When I say they, I mean my government, the American government, the Centers for Disease Control, the World Health Organization. And a couple years later, in 1985, marched over to Africa, had a meeting there, and decided that anything going on in anybody who had persistent diarrhea, who was losing weight, was also the same disease, the same sex disease. Now, in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, you have a situation where you have a continent which is not necessarily as well-structured or livable as, oh, New York City or West Hollywood. You know, there's not as much clean water. There's not necessarily access to food all the time. So, there's a persistent malaria, cholera, tuberculosis, sepsis, other dysenteries, parasitic problems. There are corrupt governments. There are civil wars. There are people sometimes marching through your village with machetes and cutting you into pieces. So what you have in Africa is essentially a very different terrain. But in 1985, there was a meeting in Bangui, the capital of the Central African Republic, where a CDC official, Joseph McCormick, decided, and he records this in his biography, level 4 virus hunters of the CDC, that whatever was going on, they would be able to start counting the cases, however imperfect their way of diagnosing it would be. And that diagnosis in Africa would be diarrhea, weight loss, fever, et cetera.